Hi, everybody here from California. It's a pleasure to hook up with all of you on, as Michael said, on a regular basis. I think, you know, it's a great idea to make this happen in order to give you the chance then to hook up with me, but also with all the things that that go on there in our environment of soccer. So please go ahead. Feel free to ask any questions you want to. Looking forward to it.
Thank you, Jurgen. And as we begin, Moon, I'd like to assign the first three questions. Opening will be Ron Blum from the Associated Press. Following Ron, Jeff Carlisle from ESPN.com. And after Jeff, Avi Creditor from SI.com. Ron, go ahead.
Hi, Jurgen. How are you?
Hi, Ron. How you doing?
Good. Having had now 6-7 months to look closely at the player pool and with qualifying 2 months away, what positions concern you most as qualifying approaches?
I mean, first of all, I'm looking really forward to the qualifying process because now, you know, being in that role now for these 6, 7, 8 months, whatever it is, you know, you want to kind of get closer now to the real challenges. And obviously, you know, friendlies are nice to play. Friendlies are nice to have. But it's not the real thing. The real thing is qualifying, and then obviously, you know, hopefully being qualified, then going towards Brazil 2014. Concerns about specific positions within the roster, I don't really have those concerns. I think that we are very, very good and balanced team. We have youngsters coming through the ranks that we are really curious to kind of to follow up on them and see how they progress over the next 2.5 years or 2 years towards 2014. Then we'll see, you know, how far they can make it. I think we have a good group of guys together. We're good balance, and obviously I'm curious to see them all in camp then in May, June, and give them even more evaluation than after those 5 games that we face.
How many players do you anticipate bringing in May, June, before you have to cut the roster for the qualifiers?
Well, I'm planning on getting probably 23 players coming in, meaning 3 goalkeepers, 20 field players, but also having a standby player list, you know, that the players know that if something happens within the camp, you know, I'm there within a day. We'll plan on that kind of a roster. I don't want to go with more numbers because it kind of reduces you the quality of training session. So that's the idea behind it for right now.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Ron. Next is Jeff Carlisle.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes, Jeff, go ahead.
You know, the last 5 years or so, I've seen a steady erosion in the amount of minutes that American players have gotten. And, you know, while, you know, expansion has compensated for this a little bit, you know, I was wondering, as the national team coach, how much of a concern is this that, you know, perhaps American players are getting less and less playing time in MLS?
Well, that is definitely a concern. You know, it's definitely a topic that we want to bring up with Don Garber and MLS, you know, because we want to make sure that, you know, especially the younger group of players, you know, get as much exposure as possible coming through that developmental stage, you know. And I know that, you know, an 18, 19, 20-year-old is not at the same level often yet than, you know, an experienced player and a proven player. But we got to make sure that, you know, they get the chance to break through, that they get the chance, you know, to get their minutes in. So it's definitely a concern. You know, over the top of my head now, Jeff, I can't give you all the solutions for it. But it's definitely worth a discussion going forward, you know. And you know, you see other examples in different leagues. You know, the Mexican league, you know, I think they have a rule that with younger players getting implemented in their first team games. You know, you see the systems in other leagues, like in Germany, you know, all the first division teams have their reserve teams playing then in a third or fourth division league, which is also professional league, to get their feet wet and to get playing time and to get competition week in, week out, which proves, I think, a really good point, because they're maturing, they're developing, they're getting stronger, they're getting better. And when they're ready then for the first team, they jump, they bring them up into the first team, and they continue their progress. So it's definitely a topic, Jeff, that we need to dig deeper into.
Okay, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks. Jeff, before we go on to Avi Krediter, I'd like to assign the next three questions. Following Avi will be Grant Wall from Sports Illustrated. After Grant, Doug McIntyre from ESPN. And following Doug, Kevin Baxter from the Los Angeles Times. Avi, go ahead.
Great. Hi, Jurgen. Thanks for taking the time. Obviously, there were high expectations for the Olympic qualifying team and Caleb Porter as a coach. For his role in U.S. soccer going forward, I mean, does he have a place either with a U-20 team as an assistant or any role within U.S. soccer in the next, you know, the next coming months?
We had a long meeting yesterday with Caleb. I actually was in Chicago yesterday and discussed this whole experience. Obviously, it's a huge disappointment for all of us, you know, not having our Olympic team going to London this summer. And the way things went there in these qualifying games, you know, raised a lot of questions, not only from your end, obviously, you know, from a media perspective, but also internally, you know, within U.S. soccer. So we worked through that process. We discussed the whole lead up towards the qualifiers. We discussed the games in the qualifiers, in the qualifying tournament, and I think I have a pretty good picture now of what happened there and why it didn't work out. And but that being said, you know, we believe that Caleb is a very, very talented coach, you know, and we chose him for a reason, because I think he has a huge future ahead of him, that he sooner or later, I mean, rather sooner than later, will jump into the professional field and becomes a pro coach, and we hope that, you know, we find ways now going forward, even if it's not with the Olympic team, obviously, because there is no Olympic team anymore for a few years now, that we find roles for him to improve, to grow, to mature in his coaching career, you know. So that could be being part maybe of our camps, you know, with the senior team. It could be being part of our workshops that we have on a regular basis with all the coaches involved and all age group levels. That could be being part of their different youth teams of their coaching staff. That could be sending him to Europe for learning, you know, at European clubs, their models, their way of doing it, you know, watching training sessions there, talk to coaches overseas, which I can open, I guess, many, many doors. So now the goal is to keep Caleb connected to us, because we really think that he has a lot of upside. I think he learned a tremendous amount during the last 4 months, you know, dealing as a head coach for the Olympic team. Obviously, he's more disappointed than any one of us about what happened, that we didn't get the job done and that we are not going to London. Because he knows that he was in charge of that process. He was leading that process. But, you know, there were many mistakes being done, and not all of the mistakes were done by Caleb Porter. So, now, bottom line is we want to keep him connected with us. We want to keep him involved in what we're doing in the future time, because we think that he will have a very positive coaching career ahead of him.
Just to follow up real quick, you said you have a pretty good picture of what didn't work for the qualifying team. What is that? I mean, what did you see and what did you learn that ultimately led to a failed qualification effort?
Well, when you don't reach a goal, and the goal was clearly, you know, to qualify, you analyze it from all angles. You know, is it the organizational side played a role? If it's, you know, is the coaching staff? If it's, you know, the medical staff? It's the player side, you know, what didn't go well. You know, obviously, you know, that third goal from El Salvador doesn't happen, and Sean does his usual kind of routine save, and it's not going in, and the mistakes leading to that goal don't happen, then you play your semifinal and you hopefully win the semifinal, and nobody would talk about those things. But that's how soccer is. But it went the other way. So the other way means now, hey, let's take this whole thing apart and say, you know, what didn't work out, you know. So that's what we went through with Caleb, and we went through his decisions with his coaching staff. We went through the participation of the medical staff, which led then to the very, very kind of late substitution of Phil Hamid in that case, in that game against El Salvador. We went through all the other people involved in the process. You know, did he really have the perfect support from everybody around him? So, you know, so you go through all process, and at the end of the day, you know, obviously you need to go through every individual player. Did the players live up to their expectations? Did they do everything they could have done in order to make this thing positive? You know, were they at their peak, or were they maybe going through a low period in that moment? I think some players didn't live up to their expectations, and they need to get that message across. And some players surprised us, maybe more positive. You know, I look at a Disco Root, or I look at maybe a Joe Corona, that have their positive impressions too. That's part of that process. You know, and I think we found there are a lot of the answers, but we won't change the result anymore. You know, and the result is a disappointment.
Thank you, Avi.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Next up is Grant Wall.
Hi, Jurgen. Wanted to ask you about Hercules Gomez. He's a guy who scored 9 goals in his last 7 games for Santos Laguna, which is leading the Mexican League. That scoring streak started after your last squad call-up, but Gomez hasn't been part of a national team camp since you became the coach. How many of his games have you seen, and what are his chances of getting a call in May?
Well, I've seen quite a few games of him, you know, over the last 6-7 months, and I know Hercules, and I know his qualities, and so he's constantly being watched. So hopefully, you know, he continues, you know, that goal scoring, you know, period, and the more he scores, the more he makes kind of such positive notes out there, you know, the bigger his chances to get a call. As simple as that, you know. And that's our message to all of the players all the time. You know, keep proving your point. You know, keep proving, you know, where you're at, you know, with every weekend game. So what we do really, Grant, every Monday we get together either by phone, by conference calls, or, you know, or in person, because Martin obviously is here around, and by email with or calls with Andy Hoofdorp and Matthias Hammond overseas. We get down to all the players. We discuss what they did over the weekend, you know, and we're out there and watch them personally or on TV as often as we can. So Hercules is on the radar screen, you know, but he's always been on the radar screen. So hopefully he can make his case stronger and stronger over the next couple of weeks.
Thanks, Gary.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Grant. Next will be Doug McIntyre.
Thanks, Michael. Jurgen, it's been about 8 months now since you took the job. I just wanted to know if there was one thing you could point to, one concrete thing that you feel that you've achieved over that time.
Well, I mean, obviously, at the end of the day, you get measured by the results, and that's why I'm, you know, going back to the first question, I'm really looking forward to start this whole qualifier process. Because you want to get down to the real stuff, and that's when qualifiers start, and that's when, you know, you really see where you're at with your group. Important was, you know, throughout these first months, you know, really that you get to know your players, you get to know the personalities, you get to know your roster, and you see your options that you have maybe in the extended roster, and then you see, you know, where you're going to lead, you know, this whole environment too. And when a main goal certainly is that you kind of develop a culture of performance-driven people next to you. You know, so we want to measure everything we're doing. You know, we want to see, do we have the best people around us? Do we make it clear to the players how they have to live their lives, what they have to do in addition to their regular routine that they have with their clubs. You know, how can we kind of help them, you know, in what they're doing, also when they're not with us in camp. And so we started a lot of different processes throughout those 8 months, and we get the feedback from the players, and we will reinforce that every time we get together again in a camp. And obviously having now the opportunity in May, June to have that kind of core crew the first time for a longer stretch of days is really important to us, because that's where you can kind of really nail things down, and you can kind of communicate things much more consistent than if you just have them for 3 days like at the Italy game. I mean, literally, you know, most of the players came in on Monday morning. We played on Wednesday night. They left on Thursday morning, I think, at 5 a.m. in the morning. So how much can you really do in these 2.5 days? So now we get them for 3.5 weeks, almost 4 weeks. This is really important to us, because I think we can bring across a lot of good stuff to the players, and also we get some real serious challenges there.
Just to follow up quickly, Jürgen.
Yeah.
Has anything surprised you over the course of that culture changing process? Has it gone the way you expected it to?
I really didn't have any expectations. You know, I mean, I'll jump into a new adventure or project, and then I'll see, you know, how things are going, and then I adjust to certain things. You know, I mean, definitely I have to adjust to the different soccer landscape within this country. I have to adjust to the fact that, you know, 80% of my players are overseas. Some are in Mexico, you know, so they're all over the place. And they come in from all different backgrounds, you know, so that's a bit of a different challenge. But I just take things the way they are, you know, and then, you know, I look for solutions. I look for ways to communicate with them in their own ways. You know, maybe I had to adjust to use Twitter and Facebook to get hooked to them, you know, get a message out to them, which I haven't done before, you know. So for a coach, it's important that you kind of analyze your environment and say, okay, you know, based on what you see now, this is what you have to do, and you have to change the way of doing things. And important is that we get the messages out to the players, and that they understand why we do certain things, why we want to encourage them to look at things maybe a little bit different. And every one of them have kind of lived their daily life in a different way. And so we have to figure out, okay, you know, how do we get things across to them and hopefully make them step by step a little bit better in everything they're doing. So, no, I'm not kind of, I didn't have any type of surprises, but definitely I saw different environments and different way of doing it, and we try to pick up the players, you know, from where they are. But we also have now, after 7-8 months in the process, we have a pretty clear picture of every player involved in the program. Maybe not going back to, you know, to Hercules Gomez, because he hasn't been in camp yet with us. But the ones that we had in camp so far, we have a good idea where they're at, and we see also their upside, you know, moving forward.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Doug. And before we move on to Kevin Baxter, the next three questions will come from Paul Tenorio from The Washington Post, Brian Strauss from Sporting News, and Ivan Skolarsep from Fox Soccer. Kevin, go ahead.
Hey, Michael, thank you. Good morning, Jürgen. At least it's morning for you and me, isn't it?
Yeah, well, good morning.
Sunny
morning.
Yeah, it's very nice. I have a two-parter, if I may. First of all, with the problems in the Olympic qualifying, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is when you took over the national team, what you wanted was to be in charge of the entire program, meaning the U-23s as well. And I'm wondering if the problems in qualifying for the Olympics, whether that has you second-guessing in any way the program and the direction that you've tried to take the team. And then secondly, I think most people felt going into that tournament that the U.S. was one of the two best teams and should have qualified, and they didn't. And I'm wondering if there are any lessons there for you going into the World Cup qualifying, you know, as maybe the players knowing one mistake can cost them everything.
Yeah, I mean, question one is, you know, I mean, coming in, you know, my first concern was getting my hands around the senior team. You know, so that's why we decided that we're going to have an independent coaching staff working with the under-23s. So we found that head coach in Caleb, and he surrounded himself with his coaches that he felt comfortable with. Still, I had a very kind of close relationship throughout those 4 months with Caleb, you know, so he could bump me with any questions he had. You know, I gave him as much a support as I could, you know, as an example, with the friendly that they played against Mexico, I gave him all my youngsters, except I think Blake Shea, that I needed to call into the Italy game because I was running out of players. So in a certain way, I was involved. In a certain way, I wasn't, because I mean, once, you know, people are assigned to get a job done, you know, I usually give them all the independence they need to get it done the way they think it's right. The lesson really is for us, okay, how far are those players really that were involved in the Olympic qualifying campaign? You know, how mature are they really for the senior team level? You know, you talk about the two goalies, you talk about a Breccia, you talk about an Agudelo, and I mentioned two before that I thought they did quite well, was a Discarud or a Joe Corona. So you look at these players and say, okay, you know, they couldn't get the job done. So where are they now in the bigger picture going into our May-June camp, you know? And I mentioned that right after the big disappointment against El Salvador. I said, well, that process for these players is getting even tougher. It's getting even more difficult because they do not have the jumping board, or I call it a trampoline, of the Olympics. Because the Olympics, if you play an Olympic a tournament, this is a huge showcase. This is where, you know, the whole world is watching and evaluating you. So they're missing out on that one now. So they don't have that opportunity to really gain very valuable experience in such a big competition. So they have to prove it somewhere else. So where can they prove it? Now they can only prove it in their club teams. So the expectations now that they really perform on the highest level in their club teams are even higher. You know, that means, you know, for Juan Agudelo, for example, he has to break in the starting 11. He has to play week in, week out with the Red Bull, you know. And Blake Shea has to prove with FC Dallas week in, week out that he's one of their best players in order to get a chance to become part of the senior national team. So there are many lessons that you take from that process of the Olympics team. And the lessons, they are a bit tougher than if they would have qualified, obviously.
And you're confident that the philosophy and direction you've laid out for the national team is still the one you want to follow? There's no backtracking there?
No, I mean, there's a little bit of a confusion out there, because some people, they discuss, obviously, you know, the systems of play and the style of plays, you know, has to be always in a certain way. And maybe that's an opportunity for me to clarify a couple of things. So a system of play, I mean, a system, you talk about a 4-3-3 or 4-4-2 or 4-2-3-1, whatever the system you talk about, is not necessarily the style of play that you want to have. So when we talk about a style of play that we step-by-step want to introduce, or we already did introduce it, you know, it's not depending on the system. That means, you know, if you want to play a more proactive style, we want a kind of more kind of forward-minded style, a more kind of high-pressure style, all these things, you know, we do not want to react anymore to the opponents. We want to kind of, you know, play our own game. We have more possession in the game. That doesn't lock you into a system, you know. The system is only a way of, you know, how to adjust things on the field and get a job done. So, you know, if you think, you know, you get the job done with a 4-2-3-1 or with a 4-4-2 or 4-3-3, use whatever system you want to, because in all of those systems, you can play proactively, you can play high pressure, you can, you know, put the, you know, the other team, you know, you can push them into their half, you know, you can be highly aggressive, and you can use whatever system you want to, at the end of the day, to express yourself and to play a certain way. So I think, you know, it is a process that we have to go through over maybe many years in order to hopefully get to a point where we are comfortable enough to dictate a game. You're comfortable enough to keep the ball calmly, to play out of the back, and not to panic and not to play long balls, just, you know, kind of to get out of the situation. And we started that process, and we'll see how this process will go towards the World Cup 2014 in Brazil.
Thanks, Kevin. Next up will be Paul Tenorio from the Washington Post.
Hi, Jürgen.
Hi, Paul.
You've talked in the past about how this country differs from others and that there's a connection between academics and athletics and how that might need to change to create an ideal development structure. You've put your stamp on the move with the academy to basically make it permanent that the players cannot play high school soccer. And you've spoken today about the reserve leagues used in Europe to kind of continue that soccer education for, you know, 18, 19, 20-year-olds. Do you think the next step in this country is going to have to be perhaps the de-emphasis of college play and that the reserve leagues will have to kind of grow into a tiered system similar to Europe? How do you see development in this country over the next 10 years, specifically regarding the youth players?
Well, I mean, that's a huge topic, which I certainly am not capable of today, you know, to say, you know, these are the solutions for it. But I definitely think that we have to get people together from all directions, if it's U.S. soccer, if it's MLS, if it's, you know, the academy clubs, if it's the NSCA, you know, people kind of need to address that all together and say, okay, how can we help our youngsters, our kids, you know, to grow to develop to the highest level possible, you know, so what structures can we give them? And I mean, the introduction of a 10-month season is just one of these pieces. You know, it is crucial that we adjust to the global game. It's crucial that we understand that soccer is not a seasonal sport. Soccer is a sport that is played 12 months out of the year. And in most of the soccer nations, it's really played 11 and a half months. So how can we kind of compete with those nations, you know? And so whatever it takes then in the discussion, you know, what is ideal for the 8 to 10 years from the 10 to 14-year-olds and further up, then what is ideal for all these kids, then we should adjust, you know? I think we need to find a tier-driven environment because we need to give a lot of the younger players the opportunity to get enough games and per year. You know, if you look at the players between 18 and 22 years of age and you summarize all the amount of games that they really have, if they're already part maybe of an MLS club system, then it's not enough, you know. So it's definitely worth it to get everybody kind of on the same table sooner or later and discuss through all those topics, you know. So it's not me coming in and say this is what we need. It's really everybody involved that needs to come together and say, okay, how can we help the players to grow more effectively, to grow more kind of continuously, and not kind of chopped off in different kind of couple of months here, couple of months there, like it often was the case. So, but this is a huge topic, Paul, that you just asked.
Well, I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Paul. Next will be Brian Sprouse from Sporting News.
Hi, Jürgen. Thanks for the time. Since you said all topics are on the table, one of the big topics around MLS the past few days has been the retroactive fines and suspensions levied on players for embellishment and for rough play. And you've talked about wanting players to make the right decisions during the course of games, wanting to make the right decisions when facing pressure. Do you think that MLS going down this road will help train or condition players to make better decisions during the course of a game when confronted by certain situations, or do you think that it's not going to have an effect and that this is really something that maybe goes against the spirit of the game? Thanks.
In which way do you mean it now? Using kind of videos to then punish players or punish people for the wrong behavior?
Right,
what do you mean?
Disciplinary, Yeah, they're using videos to go back and suspend players or fine players for either tackles that they deem to be endangering the opponent or for simulation, embellishment, diving, things like that. I believe there have been four players suspended and two fined in the past 2 weeks.
Yeah. I mean, I'll just kind of use a bit the way they do it mostly overseas, you know, in Europe, they use, you know, videos for, you know, let's say an elbow check, you know, or really bad incidents, and players or even coaches get punished then for it. I think it's the right thing to do. Yeah, it's an educational process. You know, it's not. I'm not saying that you're going to fix everything because, you know, people make mistakes and you're accountable for making mistakes. It's just a normal thing. It's a normal consequence. So I think it's definitely the right thing to do. But it's always case-related, you know. So, you know, you have to analyze every case individually, which they do, and then come up with a punishment or not with a punishment. I think it's totally okay.
Thanks, Brian. And before we move on to Ivis Galarska, I'll assign the next three questions. After Ivis will be Simon Borg from MLSsoccer.com, following Simon, Mike Waitala from Soccer America, and after Mike, Leander Scherlockens. Ivis, go ahead.
Jürgen, I just wanted to ask, how much of a concern is it for you the lack of playing time that so many American players in that important age group, 18 to 22, 18 to 23. How much of a concern is it for you that those players aren't getting enough playing time on the club level? And secondly, I wanted to follow up and ask about Breck Shea and just the year he's had. He's had a bit of a struggle this year, so I just want to ask you about those two things.
Well, I think the first one we had already a couple of questions ago. It is a big concern. You know, we need to find ways to give our 18 to 22-year-olds, 23-year-olds, you know, more playing time and maybe here and there more help. But on the other side, they also need to realize that they have to fight their way through the system. They have to find a way to break into the team. I'll give you an example, you know, with Juan Agudelo, who last year often said, well, I want to play more. I need to play more. My response to Agudelo was, well, you got to train harder, and you got to force the coach that he makes you play. You know, it's not something that is given to you. It's something that you have to work for, and you have to find your way through. We had a discussion years ago after the Bosman case in Europe happened. You know, everything opened up, the borders opened up. You know, and suddenly instead of a limited amount of foreigners, you know, there were foreigners all over in every league. You know. And every kind of national team program complained and said, hey, you know, suddenly we don't have enough of our domestic kids playing anymore, and it makes it tougher for the national team program to develop. And I came in and I said, you know what? If I'm the player and I want to break into a team, it doesn't really matter to me if now I have to kick out a foreign kid or I have to kick out a domestic kid. I have to kick out somebody to play. So that's really the message, you know, to the youngsters is, you know, yeah, we understand you should play more, but you have to build your case. You have to fight your way through. And you have to do more than whoever is in front of you. So if you want to pass, you know, whoever you want to pass there in the team, then you got to make your case towards the coach and show the coach that you're better and that you work harder and that you are hungrier. And you are more aggressive than the guy that is in front of you. And sooner or later, that coach will play you because the coach will play the player that gives him the best chance to win the game. So that is, you know, a little bit my thought about that. Now you got to help me with the second question you had.
The second question was about the performance of Breck Shea so far this season.
Oh, yeah, it was about Breck, yeah. No, I mean, Breck is going through a normal kind of period within his career. You know, there are good moments and then there are less good moments. Now he experienced, you know, an up and down through the Olympic qualifiers. You know, he experienced the last couple of months and a tremendous amount of attention that is floating towards him.
So he gets his, he needs to get himself balanced basically on and off the field, which is a very normal process he's going through. And thankfully, he's going through that process because it shows that he has a lot of talent. So, you know, his coach, Chalice, he's doing a tremendous, great job to keep him with his feet on the ground, to keep him focused, to keep him working really hard, you know. And what we expect simply from Breck is that he listens to Chalice and that he now, over the next couple of months, you know, continues on a consistent basis to show good performances with Chalice, you know. Obviously, he's one of these guys that, you know, we have a special eye on because we thought, you know, if he, you know, plays in London, you know, that gives him a great experience to mature even more and even faster. So he's not having that experience now in London. You know, he needs to mature then differently, you know, through the MLS system. So it's normal that, you know, there are coming a couple of down moments, but, you know, he needs to learn out of those moments. He needs to deal now with that disappointment of not being qualified for Olympics and work even harder.
Thank you, Ivis. Next will be Simon Borg from MLSsoccer.com.
Thanks, Jürgen. Jürgen, when you look at the results of Olympic qualifying, the two teams that made it through, Honduras and Mexico, their coaches, 10-plus years of professional experience, and also one of them coached in a World Cup. When you look back now in hindsight, do you wish you had that experience going into an Olympics, obviously with Caleb Porter, who hadn't coached professionally or internationally, or maybe you didn't have that many choices, and there's a dearth of coaching talent, which also maybe is a bigger issue of all the issues that have been talked about on this call?
Now, the question, is it related now to Caleb, or how do you mean that again?
It's related to the fact that among professional coaches that you could have selected for the Olympic team, did you wish you had a professional coach, ideally, in hindsight? And is there a dearth of them that were available to you?
No, I think just from a working perspective, from a challenge perspective, Caleb was very well prepared for that qualifying process. He was extremely organized. He understood, you know, the value of all the other teams, the opponents. He did his scouting homework, the sessions that he ran, you know, and we summarized it all yesterday in Chicago. I think he did a very good job. I think it was absolutely the right decision to make him Olympic team coach. Now, based on the results, you know, and the outcome of it, you know, now you can argue, you know, that, you know, maybe a professional coach here or this and this there should have worked out better. I think we know the reasons now why it didn't work out, and it was not because he is now a college coach and not a professional coach. That is definitely not the case.
Thank you, Simon. Next, Mike Waitala.
Hi, Jürgen. Can you tell us a little tell us a little bit about how you work with your staff, like the roles that your assistant coaches have? I believe Andy Herzog is based in Europe. Is that right? And kind of what they do for you, and when your team is not in camp, and then what they do when you are together.
When we are together, it's obviously easier to see and to follow for you guys. You know, when we work in camp, you know, we are focused on the challenges that are ahead of us. Like, you know, when we get into camp now in May, obviously you have three friendlies to prepare, and then you have the two World Cup qualifiers to prepare. So you have your people with you, and you assign them different roles and tasks, you know, on a daily basis. When we are not together, I think it's a big advantage for us now to have people spread out and get specific jobs done. So Andy Herzog, for example, alongside our scout Matthias Hamann, who's the brother of Didi Hamann, they go out there and they watch our players in Europe. So they were out the last couple of weeks watching games all over the place, if it was the Derby in Glasgow, if it was the Everton or Fulham play, if it was, you know, Clarence Goodson and Michael Parkos playing Copenhagen against each other. if it's down to Bundesliga games or if it's a game for Michael Bradley in Bern. So they're all over the place every week in, week out. Similar to Martin Vazquez and Carlos Juarez here in the U.S., you know, they go and they watch MLS games. I personally watch MLS games and be in touch with all the coaches and the players as well, you know. So different people kind of cover different areas. You know, I think with Martin, we have a guy that is very well connected down to Mexico. We know exactly what our players are doing down in Mexico. So every week, you know, we get together on conference calls or communicate by emails, or they send in scouting reports so I know what's going on. So that's how you basically handle things then when you're not in. I hope that helps.
So what exactly is your staff of assistant coaches? You just mentioned four names, is that right?
No. Assistant coaches are Andy Herzog and Martin Vazquez. You know,
okay.
From a scouting perspective, we have here Carlos Juarez, who is also a coaches educator for the ABC licenses. He's doing a lot of scouting work for us here. He's working with match analysis, our kind of technology backbone. In getting all the stuff then summarized. And then we have in Europe, you know, Matthias Hamann, who is the brother from Didi Hamann, who played at Liverpool. Matthias is also a UEFA licensed coach, and he helps us scouting players then alongside Andy Herzog. Now, those are the people of the inner circle that work a lot. But there are only two assistant coaches, plus our goalkeeper coach, obviously, Chris Woods, that is with Jim Howard at Everton.
Thanks, Mike. We have time for two more questions, so we will go to Leander Sherlockins, and after Leander, we will conclude with Michael Lewis. Leander,
hi, how are you?
Sorry. Fine, how you doing?
I'm well, thanks. You've scheduled three tough games out of your first qualifier with 3 days off in between the first three games and then 4 days between the fourth. Are you not concerned about exhausting your players in friendlies before your first game that really counts?
No, I'm not concerned about that. No, no. I think they need that.
Are you trying to get them accustomed to, say, the rhythm of a big tournament or something like that?
Well, I mean, definitely we want to use those 3.5 weeks to give them a first impression of how we want to approach it 2 years later. So you need to adjust to a fast-paced rhythm, and you need to adjust to kind of work hard and recover as fast as possible. So if we don't kind of try out these type of a rhythm, you know, we would be surprised in 2 years down the road, you know, with the rhythm that we need to go. So the earlier we adjust to that, the better it is. That's why I wanted badly another game in there, you know, and to have three games basically in a row before then playing Antigua.
Thanks, Leander. And the final question will go to Michael Lewis.
Hey, thanks, Michael. How you doing, Jurgen?
How you doing, Michael?
The World Cup qualifying doesn't begin for 2 months, but there's a lot of... CONCACAF is unique in that there are a lot of pitfalls that you might not see elsewhere in the world. Games are played in the tropics, unusual weather. Some teams have poor field. There's unusual gamesmanship on and off the field, intimidating crowds. How have you prepared yourself for this unusual ride when the U.S. plays on the road?
Well, I mean, it's obviously, you know, there's never the same environment that you face, so you just need to adjust. You know, how can you prepare yourself? You just need to be kind of open-minded enough and just take it the way it is. So as hostile and difficult environments will be, you just take it and make the best out of it, you know, and you adjust to it. And that goes a little bit back to the discussion we had before about, you know, the system and style of play. You know, you need to adjust to the way, you know, you face it then. You know, let's say you face a very difficult field and you can't pass the ball out of the back and they lock themselves in with 10 men in the box, you know, then you need to adjust to it and forget about your, you know, ideal style of play and just, you know, try to get the job done. You know, maybe you send Onyebu up there as a center forward and you try to hit them with a set piece or whatever it is. So I mean, I'm looking forward to all these kind of different type of games, different type of environments but with the same goal, you know, get the job done. I think in every continent, you know, that you face different situations. South America is different, you know, Europe obviously is different. In Europe, you know, we had to qualify in Eastern Europe, countries like Romania or Moldova, you know, where it's also very, very difficult to play, or Albania, and you barely won your games. But you got to get through it, you know, with whatever it takes then. And the same here in CONCACAF, it will be a challenge. It will be some games will be very new to me in different environments. But I think it's just important that the players and the coaching staff have to go in there and say, you know, whatever it takes, we'll get it done. You know, that's how I approach it.